Hey, everyone.
Hello, everybody.
It's Jill, and Ed and I are currently experiencing a little WebEx issue, so I apologize for joining so promptly at 10:01. but we're trying to work out what's going on with his computer. Did everyone else have WebEx open somewhat okay?
Yes.
Yeah, no problem
for me.
Okay.
I don't, but that's because I'm on the road. So.
Okay, all right. I know it stalled a little bit for me between 95 to 100%, but otherwise it opened up okay. I have to renew our plan each June, and I switched to a lesser seats plan, and I don't know if that's the issue Ed's having or not. I'm not sure. Hopefully he'll join us here in a minute. There's also someone's name I don't recognize on the list, too.
Yeah, that's Jill.
Yeah.
That's my student, Jill. He's gone.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hello. This is Ting.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Jill. Bill and Joe from NIAAA are here.
Hi. Hello. Dr. Riley will be popping on in a second, but he's having a couple technical issues with WebEx this morning.
Okay.
Jill, this is Michael, and
hi.
I make a brief announcement.
Yes, please.
So CFAS will be having a symposium at the ESBRA meeting at Lille. It's going to be on the 22nd of September, and who are part of that symposium should go ahead and register for the meeting and make your hotel reservations.
Excellent.
Thank you, Michael.
And I attached in the message that I sent out this morning, the 30-minute reminder message, I made a PDF of where CFAS is going to be at RSA, if any of you want to look at that. The online searchable program, you can also just type in CIFASD and see where people are showing up. It's a nice utility.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ed, are you with us yet?
Hi, June.
Hi, Anne.
Hi.
I'll be there in a second.
Are we supposed to have anything from WebEx on the screen?
No.
It's just showing letters right now, yeah.
Mine says Tina Chambers.
Yep.
Okay.
Mine does also.
Thanks.
It's flipping between Tina and Dan because they both selected audio, so it tries to find them.
Sorry about that. Should I unselect
them?
Hey, Dan,
are you sitting in the dark?
I can't see.
Am I sitting in the dark? I have my camera off.
Wow.
I think you accidentally selected camera, so it's trying to find it. So it's showing like a slightly purple thing. If you have a slightly purple post-it note over your screen, we're seeing it.
So how do I get out of that?
Once you select it, I'm not sure.
I could maybe just back
select
out.
Select it again.
The program.
Oh, actually, if you find your name in the participants list, it looks like you can click on the icon that looks like a headset and then unselect it.
Okay, I muted it. Is that the same?
I don't think it's the same as disconnecting it, but we should be fine once the slides start. Leah, do you want to try sharing your slides to see if we can all see a slide set?
Yep, we're trying to do that right now.
Okay.
Dan, you should be able to hit that little video thing beside your name.
Yeah.
And it should X you out.
There's a little earphone thing. Is that what you're referring
to? Well, there's
to?
An earphone thing, but there's also a video thing. You've hit the mic.
I should not. I'm not seeing the video. I'm only seeing the mic. Sorry.
Okay.
Let me just come out of the program. I'll come right back in.
So we're now.
We can see your screen.
Oh, that's me.
Can you see ours? I think it's Ed you're seeing. So, Ed, you might need to not share yours, or can we just pick it up? We're trying to pick it up, and it won't let us.
All I have is a blank screen on mine.
Oh.
Well, Ed, I see something that says...
All right. Now what?
So what do you see on our screen? Do you see anything?
No.
Are you on...
I see a TC on my laptop. I see nothing on my computer.
I see Tina Chambers.
Mm-hmm.
Name.
Me too. This is Claire. Yeah.
Me too.
Okay. So... Tatiana and Leah, at the bottom of your screen, you see some buttons, and there's one that looks like a share file, and it says share content. It's the phone, the video, and then the next one.
Yep.
Click that, and you can either share a program or your screen, but click one of those things, and we should be able to see your slides.
Okay. So it's giving us a circle that's kind of spinning around. That's why we're waiting.
I'm still looking at PC.
Yeah,
I wonder
if
you just want to, Jill, why don't you just put it up? Would that be outrageous if we just say, you've got our slides, can you just put it up for us? Do you mind? It might be easier than trying to teach us new technology. Old dogs, no new tricks.
All right. I'm going to take a roll call here. So, Jill, if you can do that would be
sure.
Great.
Sure.
Michael, Charlie,
I'm on.
Jennifer.
Yep.
Christy.
I'm here.
Cristiano?
Yes, I.
Claire?
Yes, I'm here.
Joanne? No. Jeff? Johan?
Here.
Scott?
Here.
Ken Jones?
Here.
Tina?
Here.
Sarah?
Here.
Tatiana, Leah, they're there. Yeah. Mike Setti or Allison Noble? Mike?
Hello. I'm here, yep.
Sandra Mooney or Tom Blanchard?
I'm here.
The Tories?
Hi, we are here.
Tom Donaldson or Kathy Mitchell?
Here.
John Hannigan?
Here.
Sarah Jo?
Here.
Bill Dunty and Joe Wang?
Both here.
Okie doke. Raj or Miguel or Gan?
I'm here.
Here.
Okay. All right. So the first item on the agenda is to discuss the data sharing and what's going on there. So if we can see those slides, that would be great.
Ah, there they are. Thanks, Jill. All right. So I'm sorry. I'm just going to tell you to go forward, if you don't mind.
I'm not. Oh, there they are. Never mind.
You see them? Okay. So let me walk through where we are with everything. Do you have a question, Claire?
No, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay, sorry. So let me walk you through where we are, and then I'm going to have some questions for all of you that I think are sort of the last things we need to ask. So all the data from phases 1 to 3 are, if I can use the term, locked down, and they got migrated into REDCap. And so that's sort of our permanent final storage location for the data. And Leah's made a nice table that goes through for phase 1 through 3 what's available in the different areas. With an important note that for phase 1 data that we didn't have, you know, really consistent data sharing language, so there's a little bit of concern about kind of the breadth of sharing we can do on phase 1. And the DNA is just, DNA does have it wasn't collected in that
right.
phase 1. Okay. And if you're worried, if you don't remember your acronyms, when we talk about the neurobehavior, and also dysmorphology and 3D facial imaging. SMS is Finland. SJS is the Jacobsons in South Africa. So this is the scope of data that was migrated into REDCap for each of the phases. And let's go to the next slide.
Sorry, Jill just popped into my office. So
you can't corrupt her. So here's our question. So I just have a couple questions, and I'll just walk through. And once we know the answers to some of these, I think we can kind of get our next step done. So external investigators, as we've always had, request access. Internal investigators have full access to all data. I think one of the things that has come up periodically, and I just would like to hear the answer on this call, is we have investigators that used to be part of CFAS but aren't currently a part of CFAS 4. What is the access to data? So it's sort of my impression that if, for example, somebody was involved in CFAS 2 and 3, they continue to have access to the data in CFAS 2 and 3. I would just like to hear that confirmation and if I've got that right.
I think that sounds fair to me.
Okay.
I agree.
Okay. Perfect. All right. We've never had that. Actually, it's come up before, and it's always been a little ambiguous, which is why I wanted to hear the answer. All right. Next slide.
Tatiana?
Yes?
Real quick. So can you restate that question? You said those investigators that were in phase 2 and 3 have access to phase 2 or 3 data?
Yes, so just because now it's archived, so just realize that that's, you know, they wouldn't have access, for example, to CFAS 4 data that we're currently collecting. So you basically have access to the data in the phases in which you were involved. Maybe I should have phrased it more specifically like that.
And that would be automatic. I mean, that would be just a given.
Without an approval,
they could
precisely.
Have access to others if they had all the stuff required.
Perfect. Exactly right there, Joe.
So, Tatiana, one thing, because the data are not in the same place as they used to be, in essence, they're still going to have to request
access.
Yeah. Right? So just
access. But they wouldn't need to, they just need to get access, but they don't need to write a request,
right.
Officially requesting permission, precisely.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there is this, if anyone had any concern, there is that level, of some sort of protection, because they would have to say, I want access to these data.
I want a login and password,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
They just wouldn't be restricted.
And part of the whole thing here, and I guess I just want to be absolutely explicit about it, is we've locked them down. So by that I mean we're not taking any more changes in these data sets. They're considered, locked down. So for quite a while, people could still be adding things, removing things. We're saying we're done with those previous phases. Anybody who was to go get the data would get the same data. We're not taking any more changes in that. That's part of the whole migrating into REDCap once everyone agreed that we were finished with those previous phases. Okay. So here's sort of the next part. So what that means is you have access. So where it is now is that it's in IUBox. Okay. So all that means is now for everybody who's now considered internal, they're given a login and password, and then they have access to, with Box you can prescribe what you have access to. So, you have access either to all three of those previous data sets, two of them, whatever it is based on your previous involvement in CFAS. And for an external investigator, you would, again, only be given access to the data set that you were approved for. And that's going to lead to a question that I guarantee I'm about to get from Sarah. So the next question is, and I think that part I think is pretty straightforward, is what are we giving access to? Okay, and so I think that's really kind of where I think we might have a little bit of discussion. So the way we've got it locked down right now, it's in a REDCap data set. And so it's easy to give someone access to, for example, everything in phase 3 or everything in phase 2. I think what I want to understand is, in the past, we've been very prescribed. We spent tons of time talking about which individual variables people were going to get access to. And so I'm partly asking, are we going to continue with that model, or can we move to a model where someone is basically given access to the CFAS 2 data set or the CFAS 3 data set? I think we spend an incredible amount of time when we have had requests kind of gyrating on which fields we're going to give them access to. Do they understand the fields? Do they realize what they should ask for? And in some ways, I'd kind of like to advocate that it would be a lot more holistic if we could just give someone all of CFAS 3. So if the questions you want to address are appropriate to have access to CFAS 3 data, for example, then the person would have access to, and if you can slide up, would you mind, Jill, being interactive with me, and slide back up to, I think it's the second slide that has the chart. Sorry, you have to leave Jennifer now.
Jill?
one more up. That's it. So if someone got, for example, phase two, they would be receiving all the data across phase two. And so I do want to be clear, are we okay with that? I think it's a kind of a holistic approach. It's sort of a little bit perhaps more consistent with how a lot of studies are now working, where they're posting data, for example, to that data archives for a whole batch of data. It's not what we've done in the past, so I really felt like that needed discussion, but it's a very logical thing to do when you've got a locked-down data set.
Okay, I have a question. The demographic information, et cetera, to what extent are the 18 HIPAA identifiers present?
This is all de-identified data.
Okay, I want to make sure everybody understands that, because they're taking all that out. These are basically non-human if they're not identifiable.
So, but what
that
you're saying?
Make it. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, yes, Sergio. Go ahead.
So I was going to say one thing. So remember, the way the 3D facial imaging is, it is coordinates. This is not the actual facial image. If someone was getting facial image, as we all know, that is then.
Exactly.
So that's not what that is. The brain volume are measurements. It's not the original scan. So that is a different level of data that's not part of. So this is really, it's data that can go into a REDCap. So
exactly.
I guess in theory you could have images, but I just want to be clear that that's what this is literally numerical values in fields. And you're actually raising a great question, Sergio. So if anyone's unclear, we could do a little road trip through this. I wouldn't do it on this call because a lot of people are familiar, but I would be glad to do that if that would sort of provide additional information.
So what you're saying, Tatiana, is that if someone requested, for example, wanted to do a study on using the cytokine data from the Ukraine, and it went through the proper approval channels, that they would then have access to all the data from CFAS-3?
Unless we want to handle that differently, yes.
And
I don't think you're going to get as many requests for that as you are likely for, I think, the first several rows, first several columns, which I think are related data, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. But then my other question is, and this is probably my memory lapse, but two questions related to my memory lapse. One is, so you mentioned having the investigator have contact, or the external investigator have contact with the relevant investigators. So, and I don't know where
actually,
we're
I
standing.
I actually didn't say that. So I think what we've had in the past is trying to do an approval. I think we spent an incredible amount of time on our approvals, you know, and not necessarily in a bad way, but because people had to pick like which fields they wanted to have. So it's like a whole educational process that had to go through that. And I think I'm being somewhat selfish, but I'm also trying to really kind of go with the spirit of making the data available that, you know, we have data dictionaries, we have a lot of materials. I would really rather not have to nitpick with somebody in their proposal. You've requested, you know, X variable from the 3D facial imaging, you specifically want this particular coordinate. Mm-hmm. I really don't want to then have to create data sets that have that, and then the person come back and say, no, that's not what I wanted, or have to get themselves so educated to get there.
Yeah.
And so I'm partly trying to streamline the process. I mean, you raise a fair question that a person who might be interested in Ukraine data, you know, would they be interested in the other data? It is kind of a different data set. Mm-hmm. And so if we feel like, you know, you could come back to me and say, I think the Ukraine data set should be more of a separate REDCap project. People who want that would be unlikely to want the other. But I am trying to avoid our reviews turning into a delineation of which specific variables people want.
Yeah.
I think a lot of studies, and I'm speaking a little bit out of turn, are trying to do a greater breadth of data that they're making available. And so I'm trying to do that as well, if we all agree.
So my other question has to do with, and we can talk about this offline, but I don't know where we fell on the – when Helen left, there was still some unanswered questions about, for example, the grouping variable that would be used. And so I don't know where we stand on that. So if somebody's going to have access to all the data, I just want to make sure that they can use it correctly. I'm not questioning hypotheses or anything like that.
So I guess so. There's a balance. Okay, just let someone else speak. Let me let someone else speak. Go ahead.
This is Michael, and I want to make the case for open access. I think that this has been funded by NIAAA. The data have been in arrears for a long time, and the intent always was to make the data available as broadly as possible. I think if you compare our discussion to ABCD, ABCD put that almost as soon as they generate it. And it's broadly available, and it has a really wonderful site to guide you through how to access the data and interpret it. I don't think we're in the same position as ABCD to construct that kind of online navigation, but I think it would be less complicated to just make data available.
I want to reiterate what Michael said. This topic today is not about specifics, but we're going to have a face-to-face meeting with Dr. Koob in October. And he's very interested in knowing about data sharing from this project. And I think we need to show him that data are available. And so I want to keep it more in general terms and rather specifics about what specific data point might be available. But just to get everybody online, that we want to make all phase 1-3 available. Bill, do you have anything to add on that?
So, I think you're right. The Institute is very interested in data sharing these days, and we're requiring all studies going forward that are involving human subjects to be able to share data in the NIAAA data archive. So, yes, it's important, and I'm glad we're having this conversation again. Tatiana, I would want to provide a little different perspective. I sit on the FACE-based data access committee here at NIH. The model they use, they have different phases, but the model they use is essentially what's being displayed right now and with this table, is that a request would come in and say, you know, I would like access to phase 3 data, the cytokine data from the Ukraine, and you would just have that checkbox. And then, so my question to you is, in REDCap, would it be possible to give them just access to that? And I'll explain in a minute, but as opposed to the entire data set. Not really getting into the specific variable level, but I don't know if I share the same opinion that if someone's requesting a small piece of the data set that they would want, we would give everything up. The reason being is that some of our data access agreements that are signed by the institutions, they have to say what they're going to use the data for.
Yep.
After 1 year, they're supposed to destroy the data. You know, so it's very, I don't want to say restricted, but it's regimented. And I'm not sure if I'm agree with the idea if they just want phase, a little piece of phase 3, that they would get the entire data set.
So let me quickly respond, because I would be fine with that too. What I'm trying to avoid is picking individual variables. So I've gone to kind of one extreme and was very prepared to see where I ended up. But I wanted to offer the full Monty. So I think what's really quite easy in REDCap would be to say phase 3, 3D facial imaging. You want to have that data set. And maybe you want to pair that with demographics. And you want to have those too. I think doing that. I think what becomes more tedious, and I'm really cringing at the idea, is someone saying, I want phase 3 3D facial imaging, and I want these 4 variables out of the 25 that you have, and starting then to start creating something more customized. Making available phase 3, all the 3D facial imaging data, very reasonable thing, and I think that could be a really easy kind of access. So I think that's a really reasonable place. So providing it with the checkbox format that we've got right here, I think is really very doable with the way we've kind of bundled it up in REDCap, if that makes sense.
I don't have a issue with it not requiring a selection of variables. I think releasing the entire phase is it just wouldn't be my choice. I agree with the data access. I agree with making it fully available, but it just seems like if someone puts in that we're requiring information from them about what they want to do, and then to just give them blanket access, to me, doesn't make sense, because even though we require them to delete that data, you know, we don't know what happens after that.
So do I hear then agreement? So I'm quickly pivoting to where I was hoping we would end up. And I'd hate to do this to all of you, but if I start where I want to end up, then we don't always get there. So what I hear us saying is, we're comfortable with, and this would be a really easy thing. This is partly why Leah was very nice to put this in this nice little format for us. This is a perfect thing to have, for example, on a website where you then say, here's the data dictionary. You click here, you can get the data dictionary that goes with dysmorphology phase 3. Here's the variables that are there. This is what you would get. You know, be very easy to make this kind of have some interoperability, and then someone would basically just be able to click on the boxes in essence, and that becomes their request, and then they provide how they're going to use that with that, and obviously do that a complete form. But that, to me, this would be a really kind of easy way to be able to make that kind of a interactive in a more limited way for someone to get the information they want and then be able to request what they need. How do you all feel about that?
I think that makes
so data
sense.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm good.
I agree.
All right. Perfect. So what our next step is, now that we've got this piece kind of nailed down and bundled, so we have to go back then to updating, and I think this should be on the CFAS website. So we just work with you, Jennifer, in terms of if we want to redo kind of that web page for requesting, you know, learning about it and requesting that, we just give you the text and then we can work with you to edit that and then get that up there. Do you have somebody we could work with there to mock up pages, or do you need us to do that here?
Well, I could talk to Ian here about mocking up pages, and I think the one really important key is making sure that the data dictionaries are clear. I think that was one of the challenges that we had previously. So, and Lee and I know we'll be meeting at RSA to discuss this too. So,
yeah, and that would be the one thing that would be important. If for some reason we need to do it here, we can build a website here. It just seems like everything's at your place, and so I don't know if you want people leaving that environment. It's whatever you want. Think about that. But
yeah.
I think we're ready to do that now that we've got agreement on this piece.
Yeah, I think that's good.
So my goal, and everybody on the call, is I will admit I originally wanted this all done so that we could say at RSA that this was all ready. We could do that at the work group on Saturday. And I'm really sorry that we don't have that done. We kind of got ourselves bogged down in the current data dictionaries for CFAS 4 and trying to get all that data cleaned up and everything. But I will assure you that we'll get this done so that we've got it up at by the, you know, I want to say it's going to take till the end of the summer to have all the web pages and all that taken care of. I think it will. But when you meet, you know, when we meet with George, we'll be pointing to this, and hopefully it'll be beautiful, and, you know, he has no questions, and maybe we'll have a request too.
All righty. That's what we need.
Tatiana, quick question. This is Rajesh. In your data table, the Ukraine cytokine data, are you including the microRNA data in that? I thought we'd submitted that.
It falls under the infant because it's under that project.
I see.
So
okay.
Since the cytokine one was a developmental project, that's why it's separate.
I see. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Tatiana, you had more slides?
No, just the last one was timeline, but I just did it orally when we were on the last one. I just wanted to get the timeline for it, so I think we covered it.
Okay. So we're going to move on then, if that's all right with everybody.
Yep. Thank you.
And I'm going to share my thing here, I hope. All right. Let's go to the top. Can everyone see my slides?
Yes.
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 Okay. Yeah, that looked that right? No, you got the wrong one. All right. I got to move this screen over. I don't know what I'm doing, but
sharing the wrong screen. Come on, Ed. It didn't ask me what screen I wanted to share. Well, we'll just go with, let's see, I'll put this on this one and see what happens. Nope. All right, well, we're just going to have to go with what we got, I guess. All right, so this is about diagnosis, and it's not working. Here we go. Everybody knows that there's numerous diagnostic schemes, and they differ. All right, so what I want to talk about today is some of the problems with diagnosis, and then we're going to have Gans talk about ways that we're looking at to try to solve these. Right now, there are some differences, and there are reasons to want to try to get a universal guideline for FASD, and these are just two quotes from the National Task Force and an article that Ab Chudley wrote about the benefits of having a universal and reliable diagnostic criteria. But there are a lot of things standing in the way, and I'm going to go through a lot of these quickly. All right, so if we look at a comparison, these are basically for the facial characteristics for the Revised Institute of Medicine, the Canadian guidelines, which are basically the same as the Australian guidelines, the old Canadian guidelines, which are similar to what the Germans are, and then the four-digit code. And the areas in red are kind of, everybody agrees that you need a lip rank 4 or 5, and most of them agree that you need 3 facial features, rather, to make that diagnosis, and that the papillary fissure length should be at the 3rd centile. The one that differs from that is the Revised Institute of Medicine one, and thanks to Jocelyn Cook for these data. In terms of growth, they all agree that you should have growth deficiency less than the tensile, except the new Canadian guideline, which doesn't include growth as a factor. But even if you have common criteria, you still have problems. All right, so this is the lip filtrum guide. You're all familiar with that. And according to the manual, it's a normally distributed range. And a rank 3 picture reflects the population mean. Rank 1 and rank 5 represent the extremes, about the 2.5th centile if you're at the minus 2 standard deviation part there. So the first question that comes is the lips that are pictured in rank 4 or 5, those that are critical for an FAS or an PAS diagnosis, are they the average of that rank or the lower cutoff for that rank? For example, is this the demarcation between a 4 and a 3, or is it the average 4 length? And very few people know the answer to that question. So,
is there an answer?
Yeah, is there an answer?
Is there an answer?
There is an answer. This is from the Claren and Astley paper, Astley and Claren paper in 1966. Were they looking at circularity, and you see a rank 4 is a 72 circularity. However, if you look at the 2004 version, you notice the pictured circularity now in what they're looking at, the one that we're all familiar with, it's 85, and the range is from 75 to 131. So it's neither an average or a lower limit. It's just somewhere in the range. And then if you look, these are the differences between the 66 paper and the 2004 paper. So the child in pictured in the 96 paper would not even be considered FAS anymore. So obviously the range has changed, and we don't know where along the range that lip depicted in 4 now really is. So that leads to a lot of problems. This is from their 66 publication, and the two red lines, these are control subjects, although they may or may not have documented prenatal alpha exposure. But you see that
a majority of the controls, about 47% of them, in fact, have a rank 4 or 5. Thus, they qualify for one of the three cardinal features. And these are the controls, all right? So I think that shows that there's a lot of problems with measuring how thin the lip really is. And this was borne out in a paper came out of Liz Elliott's lab, where the lip rank had a kappa score of 0.47. Some people would say would be moderate. But in a paper published by McHugh, she says for medical diagnosis, that basically is a very weak kappa, and it means that maybe 35% of the data being collected are reliable. That leaves a lot that's fairly unreliable in trying to assess the lip. So this was a study that was done on the ALSPAC database, which was over 2,000 15-year-old kids. They had 3D photos taken, and these kids, this study had nothing to do with prenatal alcohol exposure. But when you look at this, you see, first of all, that there's pretty good intra-examiner reliability. But when you look at the inter-examiner reliability, it's down to about 57%, which is fairly low agreement between examiners. And basically what they found was that about 35% of their normal their population that they studied basically had a thin upper lip, which creates problems. They also found that there was a sex difference in that males had tended to have more thick lips than females. So any questions yet? All right, so other things to consider is that we know that lip thinness varies as a function of age, so we're not sure how useful it would be in adults. We know that it varies as a function of race, yet there are very few different racial scales. The Cupid bow, we don't know if that's a factor or not. It appears that it may be, and we know that there are genetic factors that relate to facial form, including the lips that have been identified. So, back to this. This is now about the filtral smoothness. This is again from that 96 paper. And look at the controls. Now you got to remember that these are supposed to be normally distributed. And yet it looks like there's a tremendous number of the controls have deeply furrowed and somewhat furrowed filtra. And you would expect that they would be much less than that, particularly for deep furrowed. It's supposed to be a normal distribution, it'd be at the 2.5th centile, and yet it's fairly significant there. So there's something going on that this is either hard to do or there was something wrong with their control population that they studied. But Susan recognizes that there's a difficulty in coding between a rank 3 and a 4. And you have to remember that that's basically the difference of having or not having one of the cardinal facial features of FASD. The other problems is that filtral columns come in a variety of types. There are parallel, triangular, concave, and unclear, and yet that's not taken into account in this lip filtrum chart. There are ethnic differences. There are age effects. One of my concerns is that there's a potential bias in the rankings because the pictures for filtrum and lip are in the same picture. And if you qualify a person as having a lip 4, are you just more apt to classify them as having a filtrum 4 just because they're in the same picture? So when we looked at this, is from the Canadian data set. When we looked at those with FASD who had two facial features, about 55% of them had a lip and a filtrum, while only 7% had a lip and a pupillary fissure. And if these were really independent, you would expect they'd be about the same percentages. Of those who did not have FASD, but who had two or more FAS facial features, 70% of them had a thin lip and a fat filtrum, again, arguing that they appear to go together. When we looked at the correlations in both the Canadian and the CFAS samples, the thin vermilion and an upper lip are correlated greater with 0.6. So there's something going on there, and it's maybe that they originate from the same embryonic tissue, so that makes sense. But I think that bias may also play a role. And this association between a thin vermilion and an upper lip has been reported previously. If you look at back at the Elliott study, again, the correlation for filtral rank is pretty moderate. Again, McClure would say that was a weak association. Then you got problems with papillary fissures and which chart to use. So I think even if you could agree on a common criteria, you're going to have to decide which chart to use. And these are all from Susan Astley's photographic analysis chart, or her system. But you see there's a big difference between the Hall charts tend to overestimate, the Thomas charts presumably doesn't match the true growth criteria since they tend to stop at age 6 or 7. The Canadian ones don't go below 6, and that's a photographic thing. So this is just the Hall charts there. And Hall charts overestimated the true PFL by 2 millimeters. And this was what was used in the 4-digit code for a very long time. And a combination of Hall and Thomas was used by a lot of people. The area that's shaded in blue are the new Canadian guidelines. And so this is the -2 standard deviations in the Hall chart. And you can see that that's greater than the average for the Canadian, or less than the average than the Canadian charts. They're almost about the same. And yet these in the Hall definition would give you a diagnosis of FAS, or one of the criteria, where in order for the Canadian guidelines, you've got to come down to about here. So there's a big difference between the norms that people have used. There's a lot more evidence that there are problems with this. The Clarin photographic norms tend to underestimate papillary fissures. There's a sex difference as well. And Hall even said, makes it quite clear that her earlier measurements, even though they were based on good data, underrepresented normal papillary fissure length for children in North America. So Susan has come out and said they overestimate the true size of papillary fissure length. So you'd overestimate the number of children with short papillary fissure lengths. You get an inaccurate diagnosis. To contest that, she went redid all of them using the Canadian PFL charts. And I thought what was interesting is that when she used the Hall charts, the patients with FAS dealt 3.9 standard deviations below the mean. That's about 2 out of every 10,000 individuals. And not a single patient lost their diagnosis of FAS when they converted it using the Canadian guidelines to 2 standard deviations below the mean. So I'm not quite sure how that could possibly happen, but that's what she reports. The concordance of measures between various ways of measuring this isn't all that great either. Measured the discordant in about 42% of the cases when they do it with the photographic, ruler, and calibers. The calibers were concordant with the ruler only 24% and 18% of the time. If you compare all three methods, there's a difference of more than 1 millimeter in 27 to 45% of the cases. And that could have a dramatic effect on the diagnosis of FAS and PFAS, where 1 millimeter can make a large percentile difference. So I'm going to try to, this is just Susan's papillary fissure when she asked a whole bunch of experts to measure hers. And that's the range that they came up with. What's interesting is that they differ by more than 1 millimeter about 30% of the time. They were discordant by 1 millimeter or more at 70% of the time, and by more than 2 millimeters, 30% of the time. So there's obviously not a great amount of reliability no matter how you measure these things. So things, it's obvious that we're in a mess. We need to do something about it. This is the tools that we currently have. We have charts that are kind of strange and not all that reliable. We have this Lipp-Bultram guide, which I think has problems. We have this rulers, which only experts can really do adequate measurements with, and even they agree occasionally. And we have a bunch of standardized tests that we give. And so what do we need? And that's where I am going to turn this over to Gantz, who's going to tell you what he's been working on. And I'm sorry if I rushed through it, and if you have any questions, we'll try to have time at the end. So Gantz, it's up to you.
Yep. All right. I'll take a
look. How do I am I off now? No.
No.
I'm chat. All right. Now I am. All right.
Okay. Let me try to share mine.
I got it. Yep.
Okay. You see the title slide now, I suppose?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Gantz. I want to kind of go over some of the ML solutions I've been working on. It's not fully mature yet. These are just initial proof of concepts I'm going to show you today. Still a lot of work to be done before we can put it into practice. So before I go into the applications, I want to do a little bit of motivation behind why we are building these things. And Ed kind of touched upon a lot of those already.
We only got about 12 minutes, right?
12 minutes? Okay. All right. I'll rush through. All right. So first thing is scarcity of dysmorphologists, right? There are very few around. Ed, if you're wondering what this is an astronaut, Ed always brings up there are more astronauts than dysmorphologists. I did a Google search. Apparently, the U.S. has about 150 at any given time. I don't know if you have more dysmorphologists than astronauts. Second is lack of consensus between them. I go talk to Miguel and Ken a few times trying to extract what's in their head, how they're diagnosed. And they say they are in agreement on the filter 90% of the time, and these two work together all the time. And I don't know how, if you bring all of the dysmorphologists together, how much in agreement there would be. And the third thing is lack of diagnostic tools. As Ed mentioned, the best tool we have, which Ken uses all the time, is the plastic, the metric ruler. And Ken gave me a lashing last time I met with him. Hey, you guys talk about all this fancy stuff, but I have nothing to use, all these fancy mobile tools. So maybe start marching towards the universal diagnostic system and try to utilize the latest technology. And that's kind of where we're going. So before I get started, I want to throw up this picture Miguel sent me with rankings they have scored, Filtrum and Lips. Do you want to take a shot at what score you would give this picture here for Lips? One being full, five being FAS.
One.
Okay. Anybody else?
So, John, you're saying that's a complete that's a one.
It's full. Is that the question? Which ones are full?
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah, 1 to 5 on a Likert scale. What would you put it at?
Oh, so well, in terms of the Bill. The Filtrum looks indistinct, I guess.
No, just the lip, so I'll forget the Filtrum for now, sure.
But just the upper lip?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd give it a 1.
Okay, so Miguel says it's a 4 or a 5. That's because it lacks that stupid bola dish.
So that just raises that raises the question that Ed brought up as to whether or not the Cupid's bow actually plays a role.
Yeah, so bottom line is there's lack of consensus. To me, that was startling. Like when he said, he sent us these pictures, we were initially looking at only the thinness, and here is the lip, which is not thin. I would put it at 1, like you said, but then I'm trying to understand before I build the tools, what is a lip which qualifies for FAS, and here Miguel says it's a 4 or 5, and to me, okay, that threw me off the rail. So bottom line is it's not that trivial for me to figure out, as you had pointed out. I'll keep moving because we're short on time. Second is PFL. PFL is very well defined. Okay, from here to here, just measure it, we are done. But to measure it, it's much more tricky because you can get very close to the eye, and you get the two-dimensional distance. I've watched Ken and Miguel measure. Miguel says he gets much more aggressive closer to the eye than what Ken does. Ken is a little safe further behind with the rulers. He doesn't want to poke anybody. And that's not the only problem. What I learned from Miguel and Ken is they want this distance, not the planar distance. The blue thing, you're looking at the top of the head, and this is the curvature of the eye. They want the hypotenuse, not the one, the planar distance like this. So you really want a 3D, three-dimensional point from here to here, which is the one you want to measure. Having said that, let me start diving into the app since I'm short on time. I have the first one I'm going to show you is an application to measure PFL accurately with just with smartphones, no service assistance. Second one is facial scans in augmented reality. Third one is virtual reality. Some of you have already seen it. Fourth one is a dynamic lip filtering guide. I demonstrated that in Vancouver, which is Ed's brainchild. Fifth one is a machine learning project I work with Sarah Madsen. So let me start with number one, which is facial metric for 3D scans for mobile phones. What makes, before 3D scans require expensive equipment and labs, but these days with advances in the cell phone technology, particularly with food up cameras in phones, you can do pretty good 3D scans just with your cell phone. If you're using an iPhone with Face ID, you're using a 3D scanner. How does it work? There are a bunch of sensors in your phone. In particular, there is an infrared projector on the right here, and there's an infrared camera on the left here. This throws a dot matrix of infrared rays on your face, and this reads that pattern. So if you're using Face ID in the dark and you're looking at infrared glasses, you'll see something like this, a pattern. And Face ID builds a dynamic 3D model of your face. From this, it kind of looks to the size of your dots. The further away your face is, the slightly bigger the dots are, and it can perceive depth from there. So based on that, you can get depth, and there are software diagnostics out there which give you 3D scans, and it's inherently in the iPhone itself. So we took that and built an app which measures PFL. So I'm going to go through this. It's a screen recording of the app we've developed. So I'll play through it and then stop and walk through each one. So this is going to measure PFL. What you're going to see is me launch the app. You see the camera showing my face. We'll go through the scan process. And then in the end, we'll display the PFL measurement within the app. And then we'll show the 3D model. Okay, having said that, let me put my mic next to the thing and so you can hear the audio too.
Look at the camera. Turn left. Turn to the middle. Turn right. Turn to the middle.
So what you see is it prints out, in the bottom you saw the PFL distance displayed at the bottom in the end. So it takes about 15 seconds. It measures the PFL from the 3D scan, and the next question is how accurate it is. So let me go to the next slide. I have to quit out this. Sorry. So we can display, you see the little green dots here? Are you able to see in the slide?
Yeah.
Yes.
This is kind of where it marks from. This is not from that scan. I just took a screenshot of one of the things. It shows where it put it at. You can simply grab with your finger in the app and drag it over here and here if you think it's not accurate. it will recalculate the distance and give you the true three-dimensional distance, not the planar view, but actually the one we were looking for. So you just grab it, and it happens all we have using a Bellis SDK to do it. I took some elements off the, copied some of the elements from the app, but it's built from scratch. So that's the initial cut of the, so I think I'm very hopeful of this because it'll give you really accurate distance. It takes 15 seconds to do it. So that's the first app. You have any questions? If not, I'll move to the second one. Okay.
Hey,
so,
Gant.
Yeah.
The number that you showed, was that for an average of the two eyes, or it showed a left and a right PFL?
No, it's one for the left, one for the right.
It did? Okay.
On average, yeah.
You get very symmetrical ones.
And it shows the interpupil distance. I don't know, it's probably not of use to you guys, but you measure the distance from here to the center of the pupil to here. It throws that in there, too, so you can tell the distance between these two points. So let me move on to the next step, which is, before I move on, so where this brings up, we saw that 3D scanner generates from the phone, we can send it to the cloud. It can go to, like, for example, Mike Study is working on these 3D algorithms to generate heat maps. He's looking at a holistic approach and stuff, that two or three facial features. This can go into his algorithm. He can send back a heat map, which can overlay on the 3D scan on the phone, and he can maybe give a diagnosis too based on his algorithms, what he thinks is going on. So these are possibilities.
Okay.
It is augmented reality. What is augmented reality is like kind of a mouthful, an interactive experience where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer-generated perceptual information. Okay, that's like, you may ask, what the hell does that mean? To me, a simplified definition for me is like, augmented reality is like being married with kids. You get married, reality hits you, and then kids arrive, it gets augmented some more. So let me give you an example. Here's an Yelp app, a company like called Monster. You pull out your Yelp app, it knows where you are, just point your camera to the buildings around you, and it overlays reviews about the restaurants, okay? So it's like an American Airlines is building an app where you can point your camera at the airport and kind of overlays information how to get your gate, etc. So iOS has this augmented reality kit. We started playing around with it. And I'll just show you the app. It dynamically follows my face, embeds a grid on my face, follows my contours of my eyes, lips, and everything. And it also tracks my pupils in a separate demo. So I'll play this video here. So I'm trying to see if this will give me better measurements, also in terms of measuring the lip curvature. Here's kind of a snapshot, of what the grid is built. So I'm wondering if I can tell the Cupid's bow better from these type of scans, and also the eye measurements, if I can get better measurements through this route. It's kind of still work in progress. But as you can see, you can do a lot with the mobile phone these days. Let me move on to virtual reality. Some of you saw the demo I showed in Vancouver. It's hard to do a good demo here virtually sitting on a conference call, but I try to do my best. You saw the 3D scans the phone generates. We can shoot it to the cloud. You can put on a virtual reality headset, something like the Oculus Go, which costs a couple of $100s. And you can you can clearly see the facial features. If you want to diagnose, you can rotate the head any direction you want. You get clear view of the filtered ridges, the lips, and you can overlay certain information on that. So that's another way to go. Except, let's say Tina is sitting in Ukraine. She can scan a kid in 15 seconds, beam it up to Ken in San Diego. Ken can put on his headset. It doesn't even need to be tied to a computer. And you can just simply be wireless in both ends. Phone is like an iPhone is $700 with a 3D scanner, put-up camera, couple hundred dollars for the headset. You can extend the reach of your diagnosis, telemedicine as you speak. So how can I demo something like this? I know it's going to hate me for this, but I didn't know how else to do this. But I had one important edit here, so I'm going to show you within my Unity, not in a virtual reality headset, but within my software environment. I was trying to rotate the headset and capture the screen grab here. So you can bring it as close as you want to study your filter ridges, your lips, and it looks way better on your headset than it, what I'm showing here.
Couple minutes, Kev.
What's that?
Only a couple minutes. People need to have the lead.
All right, almost there. Okay, and then here's what Ken thought of it. Ken says the VR model was way more detailed examining in person. So he thought he could see my filter better in the VR headset than he could see in real life. So that's promising. What else did I have? Here, I'll skip this. Lip filter guide, you have seen this before. I demonstrated this in Vancouver, so and all the issues that pointed out. The dynamic morphing of the lips. In fact, my study did one with real data of 3D scans here from actual subjects. It's a three-dimensional thing. So that's also a work in progress. And finally, some machine learning work I'm doing with Sarah. I'll quickly blow through this. The idea is this. We have data sets from many different centers. It's got the CBCL lab scores of these kids, the facial measurements, the IQ. Question is if you can build a model which predicts if they are AE or non-AE. So we did some initial models using the data set we have. I ran some results. It was interesting, the training data set, we got 88% accuracy in training the model, but when we ran the test set, it fell to about 73-77% over thing. But one interesting thing came out was these two columns here. First is alcohol exposure, what the parents said. Did they really consume alcohol during pregnancy? The second column is what kid's diagnosis. Did the kid have FAS? And Sarah said if they had FAS, clearly the mother consumed alcohol. So the mother was not really telling the truth, or she can't remember well. So there's a conflict of about 50 kids, which is going off our predictions. And I know Sarah reached out to the PIs to sort it out. Eventually, where we want to go is, if we build this model, we have these mobile tools. We have WAP scores, CBCL scores, and IQ. We feed it into the model, and it's going to predict AE, non-AE. And finally, I want to say I'll be in RSA Saturday. I can bring some of these to show it to you if you want. Please hit me up. And that's the end.
Well, thanks, Gantz. Are there any questions either for Gantz or myself? I know we were kind of rushed through it, but hopefully you got the gist of what we're doing and why we're trying to do it. Okay, then. Hello?
Hey, Ed. Ed,
yeah.
I would like to thank the both of you for putting this together. I know it helped me understand some of the things that we're doing. I'm getting some feedback. Would you guys be able to share slides so that we could go back through this?
You know, I'm afraid I'll get sued by Susan.
We'll work through something then.
Yeah, I'm happy to share some of them. I know she already has a lot of incumbents in the field, so I am a little hesitant to share them. But I'll talk to you and I'll let you know. I mean, some of them are just published data. Others are pictures I took off of her slides. So, you know, I'm...
How about the three of us talk offline?
Okie doke.
This is Claire. I sent you around that very long, tedious discussion of Tell People Fissure Length, that's like 20 pages that we did with earlier, and it covers a lot of these same points in terms of the line.
Yeah, none of this was original. It was just basically taking the data that's in the literature. I mean, I was surprised to see, for example, the number of individuals with controls that had deeply furrowed filtral ridges.
I'm not objecting at all. I'm just perfectly happy to share that data with anybody who wants it.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Claire. There's a lot of data out there, but not a lot of control data to try to get an idea of where ranges are. But, you know, her hall data was just, to me, that was like 2 out of every 10,000 people. You know, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, I think that that's a perfectly useless measure. I mean, those norms are terrible.
Yeah. Any other issues or questions? Well, then, thank you very much. And, Bill, you want to stay on with Gans and I?
Sure.
All righty. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
See you soon.